Welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, June 2nd, 2014. Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial and your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we will look at this week's primary election, this November's general election, what Google revealed about itself and Silicon Valley recently, plans in Sacramento to help troubled tenants, and the Veteran Administration's healthcare scandal. As always, we will try to provide some insight into these topics, and any opinions expressed are those solely of the speakers. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage there. Josh Richman is the state and national politics reporter at the Bay Area News Group. You can find him on Twitter at Josh_Richman. And Bob Butler joins our panel for the first time. Bob is a reporter at KCBS Radio. That means he will have the best voice tonight on the program. And he's the president of the National Association of Black Journalists. And I believe, Bob and Josh, you both worked on the Chauncey Bailey Project. Is that correct?
Correct.
We did, indeed.
Very important project there in the East Bay. And next to me is C.W. Nevius, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. So there are question cards spread throughout the room. Please write down and submit your questions. I will do my best to answer as many as possible. To ask as many as possible. They'll do the answering. Now, on to our roundtable. I wanted to start with the primary election, which, of course, is tomorrow. Before we do that, let me, by a show of applause, who has already voted in this? That's quite a bit between the applause and the raised hands. Who is going to vote tomorrow in person? Quite a few people, yeah. And I have to ask, who has no intention whatsoever of voting in this election? I know there are a couple.
Come on, fess up.
Okay. We'll see if we change our minds today. Maybe not. Now, there are a number of interesting candidate races in the state, and there are also a couple of propositions that are on the ballot. This is not the single most scintillating election in our lifetimes, I think.
I believe this is the exact number of people who are expected to vote.
Josh, let's start with you, actually. We've been talking a lot about the Republican race for governor, or the Republican race to lose to governor.
To lose to Jerry Brown.
As
right.
Deborah Saunders says, yes. But Neil Kashkari, who is kind of the trying to position himself as the new wave of the Republican Party versus Tim Donnelly, who is sort of, I guess, the Tea Party candidate, we can call him that.
Yep.
That race has tightened up. What's going on with that race there in the
party? Well, what's going on is that Donnelly was a very well-known quantity in the Republican Party, having been an assemblyman who was often the only guy who would stand up and speak out loudly against whatever bill the Democrats were moving through the legislature. He's also been a very staunch Second Amendment gun rights activist. He's a former Minuteman anti-illegal immigration activist, so in other words, a Tea Party darling. Kashkari is a former Treasury Department official who entered the race in January and was getting absolutely nowhere in the polls until about a month ago when he started spending $2 million of his old money on an ad campaign. And now they are within a statistical dead heat. They're running neck and neck as of a poll that came out this weekend. So it'll be a real nail-biter, actually, to see who edges out the other, to come in second behind Jerry Brown tomorrow and almost inevitably, short of a major medical event, to lose to Jerry Brown in November, because most of the GOP seems to believe, including the chairman of the GOP, seems to believe that there's really no race there. So,
talking kind of about the large number of folks who have voted early, what does that play when we talk about a race that tightens at the end? It's even a smaller number of people, though, who really determine that.
Well, I was talking to a couple of county registrars about that today. They expect that as much as 80% of the votes cast in this election will be cast by mail, which means people did it and got it out of the way fast. Now, there'll be a last-minute surge of those ballots being handed in tomorrow, so that may take a while to count. But like any primary election, the people who come out to vote in these traditionally very low turnout elections are the ideologues, the people who are toward the extreme wings of their respective parties. And so that's why we've thought all along that maybe Tim Donnelly could actually, sustain this despite being outspent enormously by this newcomer Kashkari. We'll see. It really is, I hate to use the cliche, but it is a sort of a fight for the soul of the Republican Party. It's the kind of thing that's been playing out across the country. And a lot of Tea Party-backed candidates in other states have lost in the last couple of weeks. The guy who was primarying Mitch McConnell, for instance, there was races in Oregon, Idaho, Georgia. Texas went the other way. The Tea Party people cleaned up in Texas. But this is really sort of being treated as a referendum on what the California Republican Party wants to be going forward. And it'll be very interesting to see what the party faithful decide to do tomorrow.
Bob, depending on who wins, whether it's Kashkari or Donnelly, I mean, do you think we're going to see a new Republican Party emerging, evolving out of this?
I'd like to think so. We were talking in the back about the new Republican Party that all of a sudden had an epiphany after the 2012 election.
Yeah.
And one commentator who will go nameless, basically said that his position on immigration had, I think he used the word transitioned, because he'd been totally against a path to citizenship for people who are here, who have been brought here by their parents illegally. But because they lost so badly, when I say that the GOP lost so badly, mm-hmm. in the Hispanic community, he said his position had transitioned.
Overnight.
That's right. So I'd like to think so. I mean, the Republican Party for the longest time, people forget that when you talk about civil rights, the Republican Party was the party that admitted African Americans back in the 50s. Democrats in the South would not do that. And the Republican parties were the ones that actually said, look, you want to vote, come to us. That's why Condoleezza Rice talks about that. Mm-hmm. But somewhere along the line, it shifted. And now the Democrats are the champions of the people of color, and the Republicans are seen as anti. The Republican Party knows it needs to attract more people to vote. I mean, the typical Republican voter is, older. Most young people don't believe in the same things. Issues on race. Most young people don't have a problem with race. It's their parents who have the problem. So I think that's something the party needs to do. And I'd like to think there are going to be some changes. But for every time you have somebody say, well, you got to change, you have somebody else saying something really stupid that makes national news.
Chuck, we have a question here, right? That's a good San Francisco question. What about the assembly race between David Campos and David Chu? These are both Board of Supervisors candidates. I got a call from one of them today asking me what I was going to do.
What you were going to do.
What do you think is interesting about that?
I'm relieved. I thought you were piggybacking on somebody saying something stupid.
Speaking of stupid.
Speaking of stupid. Well, this is an interesting race. I think we're following it pretty closely in San Francisco. The two Davids, David Chu said it very well. In San Francisco, we're just different shades of blue. There is no Donnelly. There's no Republican. There's no one else in the race. So they have to differentiate themselves somehow. David Chu is a real consensus builder. And in theory, that would be a wonderful thing. But in politics, it's not necessarily a wonderful thing. And Campos has decided and made a very conscious decision to go after him right off the bat. It's been negative mailers. It's been a lot of stuff. Tool of the corporate interests, real estate developers. And it's working. And that race has really closed up. We started with a double-digit lead for Chu, and it's narrowed down. And I heard, I was supposed to keep this off the record, but we're all friends here, that Willie Brown said to David Chu, quit debating, you're losing every one of them. Because David Chu wants to do this measured, thoughtful approach, and Campos is going right for the throat. And it's working very well. So now we're seeing some nasty mailers from the Chu campaign, piggybacking on the Ross Marcarimi domestic violence problem, when Ross Marcarimi was going to be suspended as sheriff, and Campos was one of the four people who voted to reinstate him, and it denied them a two-thirds majority, and therefore Marcarimi became the sheriff. I don't think anyone thought that would still be an issue now, but it is. And so we're seeing Chu kind of fight back. But it's nastier than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's more money than we expected. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this falls out, because they're almost certainly going to be the two that emerge from the primary. Now we'll go all the way to November with more of this, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
And any noticeable difference between the policies that would be made depending on which David is elected?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you look at their voting records, they're very similar. Yeah. Chu will tell you that they've passed more legislation. That may be the case. But Campos is in a position of an adversarial position. So in a lot of cases, he's fighting the good fight against some things that he feels the progressive base wants to hear about. So it is possible that Campos didn't pass as much legislation, but there may be a good reason for it. And I think he's trying to play a little bit of what we're seeing with Donnelly, a little bit of the niche politician. He's going to be progressive. He's gay. He's counting on the LGBT community, Latino. He's going to go to his base. He was campaigning, I noticed over the weekend, almost entirely in the Mission. And David Chu had his choo-choo train. And he was going across the financial district, Chinatown. He was hitting his base. So it's going to be a battle of the bases, and that'll be interesting to see.
Let's talk a bit about some of the congressional races, and one that has been one of the more interesting in an otherwise somnolent campaign or election year was the Mike Honda race. Mm-hmm. And this is the race where he's being challenged by Ro Khanna. And Josh, you wrote something about some Democratic groups that have actually been kind of supporting a Republican candidate. What's going on there, and why would they do that?
Yeah, what happened last week is we saw the very first independent expenditure in that race from an organization called the Working for Us PAC, which is a Washington-based, labor-funded political action committee. It's run by a veteran labor strategist who used to be the political director for the AFL-CIO. And they bought two ads, basically. They bought one attacking Ro Khanna, because Mike Honda is their darling. You know, he has been a hero to the labor sector throughout his seven terms in Congress. The other ad they put out, more controversially, was in support of Republican Vanila Singh. You don't usually see labor PACs putting out pro-Republican candidate mailers, but the calculus that we now have in this top two primary system is every vote that Vanila Singh gets is a vote that Ro Khanna will not get. And so they hope that by boosting her credibility among registered Republicans, they will be denying Ro Khanna votes, at the very least to give Mike Honda a wider victory margin on Tuesday, at the very most with the hope, which I think is very far-fetched, of putting Vanila Singh over Ro Khanna to finish second behind Honda. Honda would trounce Singh in that district, given their voter registration. I think it's much more likely that Khanna will finish second behind Honda, and Mike Honda is going to have to sweat from now until November if Khanna has come within 10 or 12 points of him, because there's no Republican voter who will suddenly switch to Mike Honda, but some of them will switch over to Ro Khanna.
Now, so they were trying to do this in order to split the to the right of Mike Honda vote?
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah.
But they're also pitting really two Indian American candidates against each other.
If
this were a Republican group doing this, you know what the Democrats would be screaming.
Right. And in fact, there's some screaming going on. Yeah. And not so much about the pro-Vanila Singh flyer that they put out, but the anti-Ro Khanna flyer that this labor PAC put out was about him allegedly standing for policies that would be involved in outsourcing jobs. And the Khanna campaign went ballistic, along with some Indo-American community leaders in the Fremont Milpitas area, who said that this is racially coded, essentially, that anytime you have an Indo-American candidate that you're accusing of wanting to outsource jobs or you know, advancing policies that would result in outsourcing jobs, that this is, you know, some sort of racial tack that they're taking. I will not comment on whether that it is or not. I suppose it's up to the perception of the voter to decide that. But it's given the Khanna campaign a huge talking point over the last 3 or 4 days. And I believe that if you see Khanna finish in the top two, you'll be hearing about this consistently for all summer long.
And just to go back and forth on what Josh is saying and what I just said, we hear all the time about how we would love to see more civility in politics and all that kind of thing. It's not going to happen. This is working too well, and it's a real it's a real nasty business. Politics at every level, and this is the assembly level, at the supervisory level, it's very nasty, and it's just something we're going to have to come to grips with. That's the way it's going to be.
And this is not happening just in California. This is happening all across the country, where you all of a sudden find a Democratic group putting its support behind a Tea Party candidate, because the calculus says, okay, if this Tea Party candidate wins the primary, there's no way they're going to win the election. The general election. Right. This happened a lot. It happened a lot in 2012, and it's going to continue to happen.
Kind of hoping for a Todd Akin or a Christine O'Donnell.
Yep. It's not even unprecedented in California political history. And if you look back to, that's a long time ago, 2002, look at what Gray Davis's political strategist did as the Republican primary was unfolding between Richard Reardon and Bill Simon. Davis's campaign actually ran ads attacking Reardon before the Republican primary because they wanted much more to run against Bill Simon. And indeed, Gray Davis, who was an incredibly wildly unpopular governor in 2002 and was recalled a year later, beat the tar out of Bill Simon. Had Richard Reardon won, he might have been governor.
Because they were underestimating the charisma of Gray Davis.
Yes, yeah. Well, Ed, that's a mistake.
Under or over.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. We just got a question from the audience about the Contra Costa race, where the question of BART, worker strike, is the issue. We're, of course, talking about this on a day when there is a Muni
sick out,
as they're calling it. What can we say about the Contra Costa race?
You want to take a shot? Go ahead, Bob.
I heard the commercials, and Glazer's accusing Sobrani of supporting the BART strike, supporting the BART workers, supporting the unions, and of course unions are bad. We know unions are bad, but there are some things about that rub me the wrong way. Full disclosure: I'm on the board of SAG-AFTRA, a national performers union. I've been on the local board for a number of years, national board for a number of years also. It just bothered me when you find him saying that BART workers are after $130,000 a year. You know, even the BART workers during the strike were saying, boy, wouldn't that be nice if that was true? But when you take all of the executives and add all their salaries up, then it comes up to $130,000, but most of the workers don't make that much. That bothered me. That's going to be an interesting race because they're hitting Glazer and Sobrani back and forth. A lot of money being spent. I don't know who's going to win. But it's politics nowadays, and that's why most people don't like politics, because they're tired of all the negative stuff.
Just for context, this is the 16th Assembly District in the East Bay. Steve Glazer, an Orinda councilman and a former political advisor to Jerry Brown. Tim Sobrante is the mayor of Dublin. There's a third Democrat in the race, Danville Mayor Newell Arnerich, who doesn't really stand a whole lot of chance. And then there's a single Republican in the race, an attorney from Dublin named Catherine Baker. She'll probably make it into the top two because she's the only one with an R after her name. Mm-hmm. And Sobrante and Glazer are duking it out to see which one of them will get into the top two with her in November.
Like $6 million, right?
It's a lot of money. There's a huge amount of independent expenditures being made, you know, by the right. unions on one side and by business interests and stuff on the other.
Which brings up a question someone else asked, and I forget about which race it was, but any comment on why a person would spend millions of dollars to get a job that pays about $200,000?
Well, there
it's
is
what
a,
they can do.
There is
job.
A little influence involved. I was just going to say, I think the Glazer thing is really fascinating, and it may not pan out that way, but the BART strike was old-time union. That's how the old-time unions did it. If you want to see our strength, you want to see our power, we'll just shut this thing down and see how you like that. Right. And that's been the way things, you know, we've got you over a barrel, and that's just the way it's going to be. For Glazer, now Josh mentioned earlier as we were talking, Glazer's already lost the support of them. So it's not a big, in that sense, it's not a big risk. But to make this, he's doubled down on this. This is the centerpiece of what he's doing. And there are some people who don't like unions, but in a lot of cases, this area is a union kind of area. And for him to say, I'm the guy that's going to stop these strikes. I know you're mad at the unions. I'm going to represent you in your anger against the unions. I think it could be an interesting moment, an interesting pivot in politics here in the Bay Area. So we'll see what happens. But I think that's an interesting approach.
Someone asked about this, and I had it on my list of topics to talk about anyway, and that is here in San Francisco, one of the referenda is called Proposition B, And Chuck, you've written about this most recently. This is kind of a rerun, isn't it, of the Washington, or the 8 Washington.
Yes.
Could you explain, in particular, get into the couple who's making this happen?
Yeah, the Shermans. This very wealthy couple. They live in a condominium on the Embarcadero, and they've, with 8 Washington, they donated over $400,000 to stop the condominiums on 8 Washington. And whether that was a good idea or not, whether 8 Washington was, I supported it, but other people did not. But there's a very active group, obviously, that Art Agnos is a big part of this. I referred to him as Art Agnos and his Flat Earth Society. He didn't think that was very funny. But their idea is to control the water. We want the waterfront to be very carefully controlled. Now, this referendum would say that anyone who wants to build something taller than the current height limits along the waterfront, and those vary, would have to take it to an election. It would have to go to an election in San Francisco. And what there was a report done by the city that said 75% of the land along the waterfront is zoned to 40 feet or less. And the Planning Commission has said, at that height, you really can't build a building and expect to make your money back. So elections are going to happen over and over and over. And what Art Agnos is saying is, and he says it repeatedly, I sleep better at night knowing that the people of San Francisco will get to vote on this. But what annoys me about that is, if they win this, Art Agnos, Aaron Peskin, John Gollinger will have established the fact that they have political juice. They beat 8 Washington with the help of this couple. This couple now, I'm a little annoyed at John Gollinger. The day that they had to report their campaign donations, I called him and I said, when are you going to release your campaign donations? He said, around 5 o'clock. And I said, is there anything in there I'd be interested in? He said, no, it's all nickels and dimes. It's just local groups. So at 6 o'clock that night, I got on the site, and this group, these two people, had given $147,000 to the campaign.
Yeah, all in nickels, too.
Yes, all in nickels.
And dimes.
And dimes. There were some dimes. There were some dimes also, that's right. And the entire No on B campaign, their budget is $45,000. So the idea that this is a renegade group of neighbors that have, anyway, the point is, if this wins, this is 2 for 2 for Peskin, Agnos, and Gollinger. If you want to build something and you have to win an election, what are you going to do? Are you going to just throw it on the ballot and hope for the best? Or are you going to arrange a meeting at the North Beach restaurant with Aaron Peskin and Art Agnos and say, what would it take to get your support for this? And what I think is going to happen is, rather than make it the voice of the people, we're encouraging a backroom deal. And it's going to happen over and over and over, because there are, I can't remember how many acres, 1,500 acres, all the way down Pier 70. There is development planned up and down, all the way down to Bayview Hunters Point. So all of those, for example, the Giants development is parking lot A. They're zoned right now for zero height. They couldn't put a coat rack up without an election. So we're going to see tons of this, lots of insider dealing. I just think it's a bad idea, but that's my opinion.
Do any of you think there are any surprises that will come out of this race? Anyone? I mean, the thing that jumped out at me really was just the tightening of the Tim Donnelly-Kashkari race. But do any of you see anything that we might wake up on Wednesday morning and say, oh, wow, that was...
I think we could see two people who are on criminal probation advance to the November election. Tim Donnelly is still on probation for accidentally trying to carry a loaded gun onto an airplane a couple of years ago, and Mary Hayashi.
Don't you hate it when that happens? And
the
number of times I've done that.
Oh,
just forgot
darn,
I had a gun in my pocket.
Didn't take my loaded gun out of my carry-on. And Mary Hayashi, the former assemblywoman who was notoriously caught shoplifting at Neiman Marcus a couple of years ago and convicted of misdemeanor grand theft, remains on probation. Is running for the 10th state senate district seat, and that race has been the gift that keeps on giving. I mean, they are she and Bob Wachowski have been really hammering each other. He and his supporters sending out mailers about the shoplifting, her and her supporters, and she has supporters sending out mailers. The first one and the first website they set up was actually bobprotectedrapists.com. accusing him of having sided with rapists with a committee vote that he took on a bill in 2012, which of course was not true, and he ended up voting for that bill. He had qualms about the way it was worded in committee. It got amended, and he voted for it. But there's been a lot of money and a lot of mud, and that race has been fantastic. So, but Hayashi could make it into the top two there.
I don't think it'd be completely out of the realm of possibility that Campos may get ahead of Chu or make it extremely close. And the reason I think that is we've seen the polls, but not only that, but some of the mailers that Chu's people are sending out now are very tough. There's a picture of a woman of extreme close up, and she said, "My daughter was killed. My daughter was a victim of domestic abuse. She was killed. I am outraged that Ross Mercurimi is the sheriff in San Francisco, and I am outraged that David Campos voted to reinstate him." It's very rough stuff. So I know he's worried.
Speaking of the kind of the backroom political groups you're talking about, Peskin is behind Campos, right? Even though
yes.
Chu really has been, in a way, his man and his successor,
right.
Really,
no.
In more ways than just
exactly.
Literal.
And Chu, what they're saying is Chu betrayed us by being a reasonable guy. So what Chu did, Chu came in as the swing vote. He was going to, there's 11 supervisors. It's going to be 5 and 5, and somebody's going to have the one time I vote here, one time I vote here. And he's tried very hard to walk the middle line. And what they said is, you promised us you were going to be a by-the-book progressive, and now you've turned into a reasonable person. What's up with that? Peskin, I think, has jumped ship with Chu. It remains to be seen how much that hurts him. We'll see. I think what Josh was talking about before is the true believers are going to come out in this election, and that's when you see a very motivated small group have a tremendous amount of influence, and that may be very well what the progressives are definitely true believers. So
you also mentioned Art Agnos, and someone asked our clarification. Are you saying that Art Agnos can be bought?
Or sold? But no, I think Art Agnos' motives are entirely pure. I don't know if we're probably all on the same page with this, but Art Agnos was a one-term mayor. He came in with very high positives, very, very high approval ratings, and by the end of 4 years, he lost convincingly in a mayoral race. And I know that stung. I know he would like to come back and be an important figure in San Francisco politics. This is a great entree for him. He's loving every minute of this, and I think he has the best possible motives. I just think he's wrong.
Okay. Well, we have a couple statewide referenda on the or propositions, if you will, on our ballot. If you were able to stay awake while you read them, this is not to make light of what they're actually dealing with. They're dealing with serious things, but they are not of the controversial level of Proposition 8 or some of the other things we've seen. And I quizzed Josh on this beforehand, and unfortunately he was able to answer it really well. So he's able to stay awake. So I'm going to go to Josh. Josh, we have
Proposition... So you're going to make me bore them.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah, Prop 41.
As quickly as possible. Prop 41 is essentially asking to retask a couple $100 million in bond money that has already been approved by California voters, basically moving it from first-time homeowner loans for veterans to housing for homeless veterans. We're already going to spend the money on veterans. There's not a lot of people signing up for these homeowner loans. There are a lot of homeless people. Nobody is actually opposing this measure. Prop 42 is a measure that would shift the responsibility for paying the costs of our state public records and open meetings laws from the state to the agencies that have to abide by these laws. Basically, the state doesn't want to have to pay for this anymore, even though it's been a state-mandated thing. And again, the cities and counties are not thrilled at the idea of having to pay for it, but it's very hard for them to fight very loudly against this, given that they would essentially be saying, we don't want to pay for telling people what's going on.
As Governor Brown,
so there has not been any huge outpouring of opposition to it either.
And has Governor Brown taken a side in either of those?
I don't believe he has. I don't think.
I mean, it's hard to oppose anything for veterans.
Yeah.
And the other one, I don't know. Veterans. I just bought a house. They have money for
veterans? Well, they did. for about another 24 hours.
Just very briefly, there are obviously races across the state. Do we want to say anything about Henry Waxman, his race down in the 33rd district?
Like 15, 17 people running for that seat, something ridiculous like that.
18 names on the ballot.
18 names on the ballot. Ultimately likely to be won either by State Senator Ted Lieu, or a Democrat, or by Wendy Gruhl, a Democrat. It's a very affluent Democratic district, and it's just a matter of sort of seeing it all through.
I would just say I think it's so amazing we have all these races, and a lot of them are really close. We really don't know how they're going to come out. To have Jerry Brown be in a position where I just actually by coincidence talked to Gavin Newsom today, and he said that he was asking Jerry what he was doing, how his campaigning was going. He said, "Well, I had a great campaign. I had a great day Wednesday." He said, "What'd you do?" He said, "We went up to the Russian River and went rafting."
Right.
You know, I mean, he is absolutely just coasting, and in a lot of ways, he says outrageous things. He was at our ed board last week, and he was hilarious and outspoken, and yet it seems to work.
He's got 10 more times more money than both those prominent Republicans combined, and why would he campaign now when he can let them kill each other? And he can just go out and do official events as the governor of California.
Right.
He won't campaign until he has to. He saw the same thing in 2010 against Ted Whitman he was even governor.
He is unique, though, don't you think? He's got such an odd but Newsom was saying you'd never be able to replicate it. It's not like you'd find let's go find the next Jerry Brown.
No,
just that guy.
Nobody has that kind of mileage on him. you don't get that overnight. So.
Mileage, but look at governor again.
Yeah, right.
You know, so he's got all this, when you get in one of these offices, you don't do favors for people, but people come to you and ask you to help them. And sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But every time you can, people remember that. And so he's got, how many times has he done this for people in this state?
When he went to go file his candidacy papers in Alameda County a couple of months back, pretty much the only campaign event he's done. But we were asking him, how does it feel to be filing for what essentially will be your last race? He said, "Who says it's going to be my last race?"
Very briefly, it's expected to be a Republican romp, really, in the November election, congressionally speaking. In the state of California, do we expect any congressional seats to flip? Or a good chance that anyone...
I'd say that the Democrats who really have to sweat are Ami Berra, outside of Sacramento, who's a first-term guy. First term, right? Unseated Dan Lundgren last time around. He's got... It's almost a dead-even district, so he has to sweat it. And Scott Peters down in San Diego. A lot of the peripheral Bay Area races that used to be interesting, the Garamendi district, the Jerry McNerney district, not a lot of heat and light going on there. I don't think they're at a whole lot of risk. Nor are there a lot of Republicans who are really going to be sweating too terribly hard. There's the fight to succeed Gary Miller, who's retiring down in the San Bernardino area, probably going to end up being a Republican seat still. Raul Ruiz, I guess, a Democrat, might have to sweat it a little bit. Jeff Denham and David Valadao in the Central Valley, two Republicans who were among the only Republicans in the country who are loudly calling for immigration reform because they have to, given the makeup of their districts. But I think ultimately they'll survive their party's inactivity on that issue. So
are there likely to be any interesting referendums, propositions on the November ballot? Are we likely to see Tim Draper's plan to break up the state into six California? Or is marijuana legalization likely to...
We're not going to see marijuana legalization. They're parking that until the next presidential election when they know they'll have the turnout to make that happen in a meaningful way. Tim Draper's Six Californias plan, God bless him. here's a guy who really needs a hobby. He is incredibly rich, and he is funding the effort to get it on the ballot. And who knows, Californians sometimes have a wild streak when they go to the ballot box. It's hard to believe anybody would take that all that seriously, though.
I kind of feel like, and I may be wrong, but I kind of feel like marijuana is going to be one of those things like same-sex marriage where nobody wanted to touch it, and then somebody did, and suddenly the floodgates opened, and people are going to say, it's not that big a deal, plus there's some tax revenue to be had. We're going to have the model of Colorado and Oregon to look at to see what went wrong. To see what went wrong. I'll bet that, you know, when that happens, I'll bet it happens quickly.
Yeah.
I saw a story the other day that the real cost of the law in Colorado, where they're getting a lot of revenue from people buying pot. I know here in California, medical marijuana, I never forget going to a normal conference over at the Hyatt Regency and walking out into the parking, the driveway where you get the cab, and it's reeking. Now, I'm a former pot smoker. I'm a recovering addict, so I know I know what it smells like. And I was just curious. I'm doing a story on it. I said, so you're taking medical marijuana? Yeah, what for? Well, I got a, you know, a nerve in my arm. It's like, you know, anyways.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is, of course, you can sell it, but the pot fairy creates all this. All this marijuana comes from somewhere, but we really can't say where it comes from.
That's right.
In California. So something's going to have to happen with it. I actually thought about doing a column of just setting out from the Chronicle and just walking in any direction and seeing how long I had to walk before I smelled pot smoke. Because, I mean, you know, we're downtown and it's there the time.
You have to leave the building?
Oh, yes.
I would think it would be faster if you walked towards 6th Street.
Yeah. You know, before when we had Square in our building, I didn't have to leave the building. Yes. But now I do, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's move on to our next topic. And this involves Google and some research on itself that it released. If you ask a Silicon Valley executive about their approach to hiring, to getting talent, they're likely to tell you that, well, they're a meritocracy. Silicon Valley hires the best and doesn't care where they're from or what they look like. And the fact that so many of them look like well-heeled Stanford graduates is purely coincidence. Google did, I think, a kind of brave thing. It released a report on the diversity of its workforce, and it turns out that this giant online company has all the diversity of a Stanford frat house. More specifically, 70% of its workforce is male, 61% is white, 30% is Asian, only 3% is Hispanic, and 2% is black. Now, Google, as they put this out, they said, look, all of our efforts, including going public with these numbers, are designed to help us recruit and develop the world's most talented and diverse people, which one person I saw who was repeating this in the press was basically saying that's kind of their announcement to Apple and all these other companies in Silicon Valley that we're going to use this as a recruiting tool.
Right.
But what can we make of this? I mean, what was Google – I mean, do you think that's what Google is kind of trying to do, or do they have to do this?
So, you know, I'm the president of NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, and one of our missions is to advocate on behalf of journalists of color, black journalists especially, for jobs, promotions, better coverage of our communities. And one of the big issues with us, and we've been going through this for years, is talking to the media companies about diversity. And they won't give us their numbers. So we're reporters. We got the numbers ourselves. And the numbers are pretty bleak. When you look at management of TV stations, 12% of the managers are people of color. Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans, 12%. In a country where 35% of the country is minority. In San Francisco, those numbers are even worse. You have some stations in this market that have no diversity at all. A few years ago, because these high-tech companies are now, like Google is a news aggregator, they don't really have a newsroom or a news staff, but Yahoo does. You know, there are others that have, and the American Society of News Editors has an annual diversity report they do, and they sent this questionnaire to all the online media companies, all the high-tech companies, and they all just declined to answer, including Google. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy to see them release this information because I call it the 10-cent rule. If I'm trying to buy something for 10 cents and I got 5 cents in my pocket, I know I need 5 more cents in order to get what I want. If I know what your diversity is and you ask me to help you, I know what I have to do to help you. But if you won't tell me, then I won't know what I have to do to help you. So that's a big part in helping. Now, other flip side of that is, you know, I've had many media executives come to me. You're with NABJ. If you see a good person, bring them to my attention because we just can't find qualified people. They're still saying that, you know, and it's just crazy in this day and age when they have these large recruiting staffs. We're talking major media companies that employ 10, 20, 30 people for recruiting, but they can't find people of color. I don't understand it. Google's got to, I'm very glad they did that, and if you want to see why it's so important, the development conference going on right now, somebody took a photo of the bathroom lines.
This is the Apple Developers Conference.
Apple Developers Conference. The bathroom, there was a line at the men's room and none at the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm.
What does that tell you? There's a whole lot more men in there than women. So I think there's a long way to go. But, I'm encouraged that they've done that. I hope other companies do it. I hope the media companies will also get on the bandwagon, too.
I would just say, it's a terrible, terrible stereotype to say that these nerds are so far into their own lives that they don't look around and see what's going on in the rest of the world. But there's a lot of truth to that. And I think what we're seeing with these tech companies is that they're oblivious. And unfortunately, they show themselves how oblivious they are when they try to do some of these kinds of things. Even the stuff that they've done in San Francisco, where they've tried to help out, we need to help the homeless. We need to get involved. You saw that some of the quotes from the CEOs of some of these companies. It's terrible. All these people on the street, don't they realize what a privilege it is to live in San Francisco? Reality is smacking those guys. And I don't know that they are realizing this is important for every company in the United States has to have diversity. And we have to bring women in. You have to bring minorities in. This is a revelation, I think, at this point. And they're finding this very difficult to do. And what they're doing with I know that Zuckerberg just donated $120 million
to
San Francisco public schools. And that was great. But I hope you noticed also that our education writer, Jill Tucker, said, you know what, that's great, but there's more to it than that. There's more to it than writing a check. We need to see where it's going to go, what we're going to do, what are the matrix to figure out how this is working, whether it is or whether it isn't. And I think that it's an awakening. It's not a rude awakening, but it's an awakening, and it's going to be worthwhile. But I think this is very new to them to realize it's not okay that everybody's a white male in our office. That's a problem. Oh, well, we're going to have to do something about that.
I would just add that there's some renewed social and political pressure just in the last couple of months. The Reverend Jesse Jackson came through, met with our editorial board in February to talk about exactly this, the lack of representation of people of color in the boardrooms and in the staff rooms of Silicon Valley, and even among those who get the startup funding, to launch these ideas. And he then went to the HP shareholders meeting in March to make some noise about it as well. So I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about this as time goes by.
Well, there's another mission for Tim Draper. someone else asked this question, which I think is a good one. We're talking about racial and gender, but what about age demographics? I mean, again, you talk about folks who are probably in the line for the bathroom at the Apple Developers Conference. Probably none of them over 40.
Well, that age is a big issue in this country. I mean, you get to be 50 years old, and you're lucky if you're not shown the door. And when you get shown the door, then what do? Our economy has changed so much, especially after the recession, that a lot of these people that got laid off their job, there may be some people in here that happened to. And you look around, and the only job you could find paid half as much. This is happening all across the country, and I think people who are older, hell, I'm older. I turned 61 this week, so I know what that's like, believe it or not. Yeah, I know.
You are old.
Yeah, I get my AARP. I started getting AARP letters. It's like, oh, no. But I think it's, in the position I'm in right now with NABJ, I really can't work full-time because I'm so involved. But I'm already thinking a year down the road, what am I going to do? I've got my own business, but I'd like to work 5 more years, and I'm not sure I'll be able to. Just because of the economy, the way it is now, plenty of people will offer you jobs, but they don't want to pay you anything. I had somebody come to me from this online news site saying they had these great jobs, and we want to get your members to apply for our jobs. And I said, well, how much are you paying? We're paying a competitive wage. Okay, well, how much? We're paying a competitive wage. Okay, but we talked about something else. So what are the jobs pay? We're paying a competitive wage. And come to find out they're paying 40 grand. For people that are coming out of college with degrees, they want them to come right for them, and they're paying $40,000 a year. I mean, that's not a living wage in San Francisco, not many places in the country, not a living wage. So there's a big issue there.
I sit in the back of the newsroom because when you've been, you move back, the longer you're at the Chronicle, it's like church. You want to sit in the back,
so you can get out.
People can't keep an eye on what you're doing back there. But the guy who sits next to me is David Perlman, mm-hmm. the science writer. He's 95. And he writes page one stories for us. I mean, there's no reason that Dave Perlman shouldn't be working in a newspaper. Now, my idea for a book is to transcribe his conversations with our computer people. Because those are hilarious. But once you get him to the keyboard and once he starts writing, there's no reason he can't do it. And I think, you know, all of us that are of a certain age, I'm actually older than Bob, but all of us that are of a certain age have had that experience where when you say, you know, I'm having a little trouble getting such and such, and people start speaking very slowly to you, you know, that happens. But I think it's not that difficult. It's funny. The second oldest person in our newsroom is Carl Nolte, who's 84. And they asked us, they got all of us iPhones, and they asked us to start doing videos when we go out on a story. And there's a program called an app called Videolicious, and you have to go through a certain number of things. And the poor woman who was trying to teach us all how to do it, talk about a line. There was a line at her desk, you know, to try. How do I do this? Carl Nolte has become the Zeffirelli of the newsroom. He's doing one video after another. He loves doing it. So it's entirely possible. We have to. You know, we have to rethink what we're doing, and I just don't know.
I would submit as somebody who's younger than both of you.
Yes.
That's all I actually wanted to submit.
Okay, so you wanted to
say. I would submit that maybe, you know, the jobs that we do as journalists, and even, you know, as we're called upon to shoot video and do social media and whatever else, is fundamentally different from what we're looking at in Silicon Valley. I mean, you know, the people who are getting hired into these jobs, who are coming out of school with degrees and going to work for a Google or a Yahoo, are people who were raised speaking this code as a language practically. You know, I mean, they have grown up in this generation, and it's hard to imagine the amount of job retraining that gets someone of my age or your age or your age to that level. You know, as a second language, essentially, you know, to come at it at this point in our lives is a difficult thing, and I think that's sort of the problem that we're seeing in terms of the ageism in Silicon Valley, is that if you have a native speaker, you're going to hire the native speaker.
Do you think there's some of the political backlash we see, you know, the whole Google bus protests, all of that stuff? It's not just that folks are complaining about other people coming into this city and, you know, pushing up the rents and the housing, but that it's people from a corporate culture that most people have no chance of getting into for those reasons you've talked about, as well as for myopic reasons among the Silicon Valley companies that are doing the hiring.
Right. I agree with Josh. I mean, I don't think any of us is going to learn to code. Right. You know, that's not going to happen. But there have always been a number of people who are engineers who are deeply, deeply into that. My father was an electrical engineer. I didn't understand half of what he said. He would always bring me to the office and show me what he was doing, and I don't know what that is, but it's just different. It's different people. But there are still places for those people. But I think there is also a sense of, gosh, I wish I knew how to do that. So and so just started an app, just had a startup and started an app, and he's making a lot of money, and I just don't know that I can do that. What is it? So maybe we don't want those people. Maybe that's the theory. Carl Nolte's theory is everybody that comes to San Francisco says the city was perfect the day I arrived, and it should stay like that.
Let's move on to our next topic then, and that is one way that San Francisco is not staying the same. We've, of course, been seeing a lot of news coverage over the past couple of years about evictions, especially in San Francisco, the use of the Ellis Act, which is a statewide law that allows landlords to evict folks. Is it when they're getting out of being a landlord, when
they have to say that they're going to no longer rent, it's no longer going to be an apartment, it's going to be, they're going to either use it for personal use or they're going to sell it. They're going to sell it as a condominium.
Now, last week, the state senate in Sacramento voted really twice on a bill, more or less, to change the Ellis Act eviction rules just for San Francisco. This was it's called SB 1439, and Mark Leno had tried to pass the bill on Wednesday, got shot down, came back, made a few adjustments, and got it passed on Thursday. It's a bill supported by San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee that would, again, apply only here and basically make it more difficult to.
You have to, if you buy a building, you have to own it for 5 years before you can flip it. You know, you have to make an honest commitment to, if you buy an apartment building, you have to be a landlord for 5 years. At the end of that time, if you really are going to do that, then you can do it. It delays the overall idea. It's probably not the end of the world solution. It's funny because Mark Leno actually did a public shaming for two bills that he had. The first was the kill switch for the iPhones actually Apple was willing to do it, but you know, cell phones have the ability to have a kill switch, so you can turn it. They call it bricking. You can actually get on a website on the cloud and click a button, and your phone is useless. So if someone's go ahead.
I was just going to say yes. If someone steals
steals your phone,
which is a very big problem here,
and that did not pass, and it was kind of incomprehensible. You know, the number of cell phone theft in San Francisco, just for example,
and Oakland.
Well, and across the country. They call it apple picking. You know, they come over and they steal your phone. They take it directly to somebody. He cracks it. It's out of the country before you know it. It seemed like such a logical idea, but the phone companies, especially the service providers, were not in favor of it, and they really pressured these people. So the thing lost by one vote, and there was an enormous outcry and kind of a public shaming by Mark Leno. Next time it comes up, it wins in a landslide. You know, people realize that this doesn't look good, that I'm voting against this. And the same thing happened with the Zelos Act. Mm-hmm. It lost by a vote. It came back, and I think it passed, I don't know if it was 21-9 or something like that. It was completely lopsided. So maybe there is some role for the media to call attention to make a public show of what's going on. But, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that works.
Well, next I wanted to talk about the Veterans Administration scandal. Can I just ask how many veterans do we have in the audience? Quite a few. In fact, I wanted to start with you, Bob, because you're not only a Navy veteran, you're the son of a Navy veteran. What do you make of what happened and the fallout then in which the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, had to resign?
Well, I guess in politics you have to have a scapegoat, and he was a scapegoat. He was also the scapegoat back in 2003 when he said we're going to need more troops to control Iraq. And they say he was forced to retire. He was going to retire anyway. I think they just kind of eased him out the door because he was right. That was proven to be right. The VA is, boy, talk about a bureaucracy. You know, I did a series of stories, maybe it might have even been 10 years ago, because I got a call from a veteran who was saying, when I joined the Navy, I was told if I do my 20 years, I'm going to have a pension and health care for life. And they told every veteran in here was told the same thing, right? You stay in, you get your pension, health care for life. Am I right about the health care part? Okay. So anyways, that was great when we had bases all over the country.
Yeah.
Because you just go to the dispensary or the Navy hospital. Well, now we don't have the hospitals. So they started this thing called TRICARE. And this guy was telling me they called it try and get care because it was so difficult. And it turned out that the reason why it was so difficult to get care is because they were still using paper records. Everything was being done by paper. It had to be processed on paper, not computers. And so I think the problem we're seeing now was inevitable. Mm-hmm. The only thing that bothers me, it didn't start, in 2012 or in 2010. It's been going on for years and years and years and years and years.
The question, I guess, then for Shinseki, yes, he's a scapegoat, but he was in that position for 5 years. Shouldn't he have raised alarm bells, or was he doing stuff behind the scenes and it just caught up?
I think the issue with when you deal with the government, and after being in the military, the general is just like a company. The CEO might say do it, but it's the deputies underneath that have to execute it. And if they don't do it, then it doesn't get done.
Especially if Congress doesn't authorize any money for it.
Yeah, and especially if Congress doesn't care about it. You look at the last 10, 12, 15 years, the veterans, we talk a great game about the veterans, but when it comes to really taking care of them, we don't do a good enough job of doing that. We all support the troops, but I got to get this guy a CAT scan? Well, that's going to cost us money. It shouldn't be like that, but that's the way it is.
I just think it's a horrible national embarrassment that we have treated the veterans like this. And Shinseki may have been a scapegoat, but somebody had to go. We had to make it clear that this is a big deal, we're taking it seriously, and as nice a guy as he is, he's got to go, and we've got to bring in somebody else with a mandate to do something. I mean, John Stewart has been showing those files, those cardboard boxes of those paper files for years, and laughing in a sense, but in a sad way at what a terrible mess this is. And it makes you kind of ashamed that we're doing such a poor job with our veterans who died, some of them, waiting for care.
Yeah,
there's no excuse.
The poster child, if you will, for the dysfunctional and dishonest treatment was the Phoenix VA hospital, mm-hmm. where about 40 deaths occurred from people who were waiting for treatment. There was an internal report. In fact, this report was what Shinseki delivered to President Obama on the day he then resigned. But an internal VA report that just revealed this incredibly, no other word for it, bureaucratic, complicated, complex scheduling process, wait time performance targets that they just couldn't meet. They were unrealistic. There was no way they could even keep up with it. Reports of staff who were instructed to enter false information on the scheduling stuff. Attempts to make the waiting times appear more favorable than they really were. Will a new person be able to change that, or is it?
I have grave doubts mm-hmm. that somebody's going to come in and take the job and have it changed right away. You got to think about all the veterans we have in this country. Think about the millions and millions of veterans that we have in this country, and then think about where they're going to get care. How many VA hospitals are there in the Bay Area? Like two, three? You know, that's it for this entire region. Yeah. Like I said, before when we had bases, we had, you know, the Oakland Army Base, the Naval Supply Center, the Naval Air Station, Alameda. They all had medical facilities, and it was easy to get the care. Now that we've downsized so much, I don't think this is going to go away anytime soon.
Interesting. Josh, when Washington politicians began calling for Shinseki to resign, initially it was the GOP politicians who were doing it, but some Democrats joined that pack. Including some California Democrats. I mean, can you talk about kind of who said what among some of the bigger names in the Democratic?
Yeah, project? I think the California Democrats who called for Shinseki's resignation were the ones who feel like they needed to do so politically. The Democrats who were fighting for their seats, you know, who need to be as seen as centrist and independent of the party as possible. So Ami Berra, as I mentioned before, near Sacramento, Scott Peters in San Diego, Jerry McNerney, who I think, you know, is less threatened, but has actually been very active, very vocal on veterans issues from the get-go, mm-hmm. for, you know, over several terms in Congress. Yeah. So I wasn't surprised to see him do that. But yeah, you know, they did what they had to do politically, I think.
It may not be apt, but I had an old coach who used to say that to get the attention of the team, you may have to shoot a prisoner and let them know you mean business. And Shinseki, unfortunately, was in the crosshairs. That's the way it goes. But anything that makes this a louder, bigger issue that outrages people is a good thing at this point. This is, as I said, it's an embarrassment.
Let's try to get in a few more questions before we do our news quiz. We talked earlier about Jerry Brown saying, jokingly or straight, we're not sure. This might not be his last race.
Yep.
Someone asked, what do you think Jerry Brown will run for in 2018?
Well, he talked about how he had just, the day he made that comment, he said he had just been over talking to some people in Oakland City Hall, and it was really vibrant, and it seemed like there was a lot of activity and a lot of energy going on there. So maybe he'll come back and be mayor again.
He was thinking, I could really do something with this place.
Again.
Again.
You know, maybe they won't have 15 candidates if he runs.
That's right.
Yeah.
Willie Brown had something in his column this week that really rang true. We, as I said, we had Jerry Brown in at our Ed Board meeting 2 weeks ago. And he was so engaged. He sat at the table and he took on everybody. Deborah Saunders, who's our conservative columnist, was going after him. And, boy, he was giving as good as he got. And he was one energized guy. And then he got up and he looked a lot older. How old is he? He's
76?
76, 78, whatever.
I still think he could probably take me in a fight.
Well, he's a vital guy, but he's getting older. He definitely is.
Yeah.
And I think he loves the battle. I think he loves to be in the arena, all those kinds of things. But he won't go on forever, and I think it probably is physically difficult.
Yeah, he's one of the few electeds I've seen where his staff almost has to drag him out of editorial board meetings because mm-hmm. he would keep... You know, keep the repartee going as long as we wanted if they didn't tell him he had to be somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So.
What about Gavin Newsom? Will he run for governor in 2018? And what about Kamala Harris? Any thoughts on those two?
Yes, unless one of them runs for Senate. Should Dianne Feinstein or Barbara Boxer announce an intent to retire after their current terms are up? The possibility of a Senate seat, and then the 2018 gubernatorial election. You're going to see people like Newsom, Harris, Steve Wesley is going to come back. Who else is standing in line there? I'm forgetting somebody prominent.
Gray Davis.
Yeah. No, not Gray
not
Davis.
Gray Davis.
we're not going to see a sudden resurgence of Gray
well,
Davis.
Well, as I said, ironically, yeah. I did just sit down with Newsom today, and he's still Gavin Newsom. I believe he talked for an hour.
That was from one question.
And then for my second question, I think I went through two pens. But
you should go to the Senate because he's good at filibuster.
He is. He's still a fascinating guy. He really is. But one of the things that he said was that he got the message. He said for the first year of having this job as lieutenant governor, he was miserable. He said, I've been sprinting my whole life. I've been getting things done. I was calling up Ed Lee and telling him, here's an idea I had. Here's another thought I had. And he was going to Jerry Brown and saying, I'm thinking about forming a task force to do something on the homeless.
Jerry's like, yeah.
And Jerry said, no, you're not going to do that. Yeah. Jerry said, yeah. No. And he said it took me a year and a half to realize, okay. He said, actually, Willie Brown wrote in a column, Gavin, you're not the governor. And he said, okay, I get it. I'm not the governor, okay? So he's got three kids. He's very involved in that stuff. He's definitely biding his time, waiting for whichever opens up, if it's Dianne Feinstein in the Senate, if it's the governor's race. I think he likes the mayoral model. He likes the idea of getting his hands dirty with that. Mm-hmm. And he's still a charismatic, great-looking guy with a little bit of gray hair now. So maybe he's even got some gravitas.
I'm going to have to do our last question here before we go to the news course. And that is, we talked about the number of folks who are going to be doing the voting by mail. Mm-hmm. Someone asked, isn't it a little late to dump money into a campaign if 80% have already voted? Just diminishing.
But if you're a politician, you never give up. And if you have the money to spend, you're going to spend it. I mean, that's most people think, why? Well, I wouldn't spend that much money. But you're right. It doesn't make any sense that you're going to spend, all this money for a job that pays you a fraction of what you're going to spend. But I think that, people are going to say, well, if I get in there, when I get out, then, I can parlay that experience into something that's going to pay. That's what I'm hoping my term ends. But that's really what happens. So, it doesn't make any sense, but people really, really want it. And if they figure if it's a close race, that last push might get them those 10 extra votes they need.
Last push means last push. The only candidate I know who's not going to be out campaigning tomorrow trying to get out the vote is Jerry Brown.
Okay. Well, very good. Let's move to our news quiz. And if my assistant can come forward. What I'm going to do is...
You have to take a test?
No.
No, okay. This is for them.
Well, that's for them, not for us.
Thank you.
The words are don't call out any answers.
Yes.
Yes.
No cheating. I'm going to ask the question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you. Give the answer nice and loud. If you win, we've got a nice little Ghirardelli chocolate for you. So let's start with number one. The United States got back soldier Bo Bergdahl in a prisoner swap with whom? Right here in front. I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. The answer was the Taliban. Afghanistan's president was not pleased about that. In fact, he was complaining today. He was not told about it in advance, I guess, because they were afraid it would leak. Okay, this next question. The United States House of Representatives voted to end prosecution of whom? Did anyone see the story? Yes.
Marijuana.
Medical marijuana? That's correct. I should stress the GOP-led House of Representatives voted that. Okay.
But the Senate has yet to act.
Yes. In her new book, Hillary Rodham Clinton devotes a chapter to defending her response to what? And sir, I saw your hand first. I'm sorry?
Benghazi,
that's right. Let's see how many of you saw this story. This happened today. What was Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan spotted doing? Standing in the back. That's correct. We obviously should have talked about that. That's really interesting.
No doubt.
No doubt.
Okay. What celebrity?
That's why we have 14 candidates.
I'm sorry, I didn't read that. She was texting while she was driving, and someone got a video of her doing that. What celebrity is in hot water yet again, this time over an old video of him making a racist joke? Sir? That's right. Justin Bieber. The gift who keeps on giving. Okay. President Obama's administration today proposed to cut what by 30%? Sir? Sorry?
Carbon emissions.
That's correct. From power plants. This Wednesday marks the quarter century anniversary of the bloody end of what? Sorry? You were thinking correctly. We've got a winner over there. The Tiananmen Square massacre. In fact, China has blocked Google because of this.
Again?
Again. Yet again. Yes. And can I ask how many prizes do we have left?
We've got three.
Okay, then. What former journalist and civil rights activist, among many other jobs, died last week at the age of 86? Ma'am? Maya Angelou, that's right. What international sporting competition has been embroiled in fresh allegations of bribery, ma'am? The World Cup, that's right, being held in Qatar. And I believe this is the last one. Senator Dianne Feinstein and Secretary of State John Kerry have both called for whom to return to the United States and... I saw her name first, I'm sorry. In the blue. Edward Snowden, that is correct. In the blue right there. Well, thank you, everybody. I want to thank our panel, Bob Butler, C.W. Nevius, Josh Richmond. Thanks to all of you here, everyone listening and watching online. We'll have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss in a few weeks on Monday, June 30th, when we return for our next week-to-week. Thank you very much for being here. Have a great night.